Well, good evening and welcome to the third presentation in our seventh year of the series Far Away Places with Strange Sounding Names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I moderate this series with my colleague back in the blue, Peggy Wright, with assistance from our website guru, Haiwang Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson, at the back. Our technical specialist tonight is David Runner, somewhere around. While a history student at the University of Calgary, I once took a course on the history of Africa from Donovan Williams, who's a famous African history professor from South Africa, and he assigned us, each of us, a paper on an African explorer to do, and I was assigned to do a paper on Mungo Park and his travels into darkest Africa. Mungo Park, unfortunately, disappeared while searching for Timbuktu and the Niger in 1805. And it was not until 1829 when a Frenchman actually got to Timbuktu. And although new to European trade, this region had been going, trade had been going on in this region for almost 1,000 years. And we're fortunate tonight to have as our speaker a man who's devoted much of his career to uncovering the history of this exotic region. Ronald Messier is a professor of Middle East history at Vanderbilt University. His teaching and research have focused on Islam and North African architecture and archaeology. For more than a decade, he directed the excavation of the ancient city of Sijilmassa, located in southeastern Morocco, famous for its gold trade and its contacts with Timbuktu and other cities in West Africa. More recently, he's been at work excavating the medieval city of Agmat, 30 kilometers from Marrakesh, which was once the chief commercial and cultural center of this region. He's the editor of Jihad and Its Times, published by the Michigan Center series on the Middle East and numerous articles on medieval Morocco. He's won awards for his teaching and his research, and in 1993 was Tennessee's Professor of the Year. It's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Ronald Messier to talk to us tonight about medieval Morocco. Dr. Messier.
Well, good evening, folks. Is my microphone working?
Yes.
Good. I don't teach on Fridays, and we have, Vanderbilt has all of next week off for Thanksgiving, so I'm happy to announce that I'm beginning my Thanksgiving break with you folks. I taught late this afternoon and came directly here, so this is, I am now officially on vacation, and I can't think of a better place, really, and I'm really elated that we have so many people here. I assure you that my last class this afternoon was not standing room only. Many of them had already left for vacation. And we'll be talking about two places in Morocco tonight, and Brian already told you the names of both of these places. One of them is Sijilmassa, which is, this has got to warm up here, I guess. Yeah, right here. I had to type these on the map. I don't think you would find a map of Morocco where either of these cities would be listed, Sijilmassa and Agmat. Neither of them are cities anymore. They were cities back in the Middle Ages. Today they're pretty much buried under the desert sand. But they're beginning to come to light. And these two sites are connected at least in two ways. One of the connections, in fact, the connection that drew my attention to both of them is a particular Moroccan dynasty. Not Moroccan originally. They were the Almoravids who came from deep in the Sahara Desert. Some of you might have heard of the Almoravids. The Almoravids were the bad guys in the El Cid movie. Okay? And they came to Morocco and landed initially in this city of Sijilmassa, which was a desert entrepot. It was like a springboard upon which they landed, which then jettisoned them to control the rest of Morocco. And the second place they went from Sijilmassa was Agmat. Agmat was already a very large city, a very important commercial center, and it was the most important city in southern Morocco well before Marrakesh even existed. In fact, you could consider Agmat the predecessor of Marrakesh, and we'll talk a little bit more about why that change took place as we go through it. And then the other connection, of course, is that I worked in both of those cities, starting first in Sijilmassa, and then most recently, just for the last 2 years, in Agmat. So that's the route from Sijil Massa to Agmat, Agmat to Marrakesh. Now, so the talk will really be in two parts. We'll talk about Sijil Massa first, probably a little bit more about Sijil Massa since I worked there for 10 years as opposed to 2 years, so I know a little bit more about Sijil Massa than Agmat. I hope that doesn't remain to be the case. So I'm going to start with a rhetorical question, and I already know the answer to this question because Brian already mentioned Timbuktu. But I'm sure all of you heard about Timbuktu well before that, right? So if I ask, have you ever heard of Timbuktu, the answer is obviously yes. But the next question is not so rhetorical. Do you remember the first time that you heard about Timbuktu, or at least the context in which you heard about Timbuktu? Yeah, you do? So what's the context?
The end of the earth.
The end of the earth, yeah. And I was a little kid. I mean, the first time I heard about Timbuktu, I was a little kid. I don't remember exactly what I had done, but I'm sure it was bad. Because my father said, if you do that one more time, I'm going to knock you from here to Timbuktu. And I could judge by the tone of his voice that it was very, very far away. And it is. So if this is the desert, Timbuktu is here at the very southern edge of the desert, and Sijil Massa is at the very northern edge of the desert. And there we are, sitting on the edge, and that's not me, that's a colleague, sitting at the edge of Timbuktu, looking north, and it's really at the edge of the earth. I mean, so that image of Sijil Massa being at the edge of the world, about as far as you can be from anything else, is pretty accurate. So think of these two cities, Sijil Massa at the one end and Timbuktu at the other end, as port cities. The desert being like the ocean. In fact, during the Middle Ages, when Arab geographers wrote about these two cities, or when they wrote about the desert, they described it in nautical terms, and they described traveling from one city to the other in nautical terms. One had to navigate to go from one to the other. So this cliche that we often hear that the camel is the ship of the desert is more than just a cliche, right? In a very literal sense, back in the Middle Ages, it was the ship of the desert. And traffic was going, obviously, in both directions, from north to south and south to north, from one port city to the other. And there were a couple of products driving this trade. Coming from south to north was gold. West Africa, up until the discovery of the New World, was certainly the single most important source for gold for any place around the Mediterranean. And that gold had to travel across the desert, obviously, from West Africa to North Africa, and then from North Africa to wherever else it went. And this is a coin that was struck in the mint of Sijil Massa. In fact, one of the reasons that I got interested in Sijil Massa, not just because of the Almoravids, but because of my PhD dissertation. I did a dissertation on the circulation of gold currency around the Mediterranean in the 11th and 12th centuries. And as I was going from museum to museum and reading the legends on the coins, I was just incredibly struck by the fact that about 25% of all of the coins that I read were minted in the city of Sijil Massa. And I'm thinking, Sijil Massa, wow, must have been a pretty important city. About which almost nothing is written. If we could take all of the texts, that medieval texts that is, that mention Sijil Massa and put them all in one place, probably not more than 15 pages. Right. So an incredibly important city, relatively little about which is known. The other really important product that's driving this trade is this right here. Does anybody know what that is? Anyone? Salt that was literally cut out of the floor of the desert in blocks. And again, reading the medieval texts about some of the towns that were built as way stations across the desert, they say that the buildings in these towns were made out of blocks of salt. And I thought that was probably a myth until I actually saw them do that, to cut these blocks, and the blocks are solid enough to make buildings. And of course, you might think, well, what happens when it rains? Well, desert doesn't rain. So. And so here's the way the commerce worked. Products from all over the Mediterranean gathered here at this entrepot in Sigil Massa, and we're talking about manufactured goods of various kinds, textiles, leather goods, ceramics, metal utensils of various kinds, and then they would be placed in the hands of caravaneers, and these caravans would go south about halfway, a little more than halfway across the desert to this region of Terraza, which is where they were cutting salt out of the floor of the desert, and they would trade a certain portion of their manufactured goods for salt. And then they carried the salt south of the desert to exchange the salt for gold. And this is an exaggeration for sure. The texts say that they traded salt for gold on a weight-for-weight basis. Pretty good deal. Right, so a block of salt, block of gold. Surely an exaggeration, but it still, I think, underscores how valuable the salt was. Salt is, particularly in a region like Timbuktu, essential for life, crucial. And there were no other sources. Right? And the cost of salt was driven up tremendously because of the cost of transportation. In fact, the rule was that the actual cost of the salt was 1/10 of what you paid for it. 9/10 of the cost was transporting it from its source in the middle of the desert, which is about 600 miles away, by camelback. You could think of it actually sort of like a triangular trade. You might remember that in the early history of our country. Trade from Europe to Africa, Africa to the New World. And this was a kind of a triangular trade, right? So North Africa to the middle of the desert, middle of the desert to Sub-Saharan Africa, and then Sub-Saharan Africa back to North Africa to start the cycle over again. This is what Sigil Massa looks like today. That's what it looked like the first day that I walked on the place. In fact, I had the first time I went to Morocco in the mid-60s, 1967 actually, I couldn't get any of my Moroccan friends to go there. They said, I was reading these names on the coins and I really wanted to go there, and they said, oh, so far away, they said, there's nothing to see there, a few broken mud walls. You know, who wants to travel for 3 days out into the desert to see broken walls? But I finally went, and I was amazed. I was truly amazed at what was on the surface. I mean, broken walls, like they said. But besides that, potsherds, huge amounts of potsherds. I think if I would have had a dump truck and drove around and picked up potsherds just on the surface, I could have filled it up 3 or 4 times probably. And it's so amazing, I'm thinking, wow. And the rule is that what's on the surface is somehow some indication of what's below the surface. And we should have representative samples and representative proportions under the ground as to what's on the ground. Okay. So the next step was to obtain some aerial photographs. The French did very extensive photographing during French colonization period. And I was able to obtain photographs in stereoscopic pairs. So some of you might remember as a child, or maybe later, having a ViewMaster. Remember the old ViewMaster? A ViewMaster is an inexpensive stereoscope. And you might have noticed that for every picture you see in the ViewMaster, there are two pictures on that little cardboard disc that you put in the machine, right? And that's because you have to look at these photographs in stereoscopic pairs. And you might not have noticed that the two pictures were not identical. I mean, they were the same thing, but not identical. So if I were to take a picture of you in stereoscopic pairs, I would take a picture here, boom. And then I would walk over here and take another picture of you. And then the ViewMaster superimposes those two pictures. Okay, and it makes it three-dimensional. That's the whole point of the ViewMaster, right? And so, I've identified a few places here. Most of the archaeological site is in this triangle. A few traces of things here, and I identified those as individual villas. And then this Bab Fez, Bab means gate. This is the northernmost part of Sigil Massa. I mean, at one point there was a circuit wall around the whole complex. Most of that's gone, but the main gate is still there. And here's a detail of the triangle, and you can begin to see features. Right? You can see some broken walls here, and you can see these sort of like moon craters. And then you can see this extended mound here, and then at a right angle another extended mound like that. What causes mounds like that? Well, we think, I mean, we were hypothesizing wind-blown sand, blown or gathered on top of subsurface walls. And those kind of features literally jump out at you when you look at them in stereoscopic pairs. So then we started producing a map on that basis where we thought there were walls based on these aerial photographs. And we tested that out by walking on the ground to see if what we thought were walls, and in some cases they were above ground, some cases they were below ground. But then you can start connecting the dots, right, between what you see and what you think should be there. But at a certain point, you have to dig to find out if what you think is underground is actually there. So in the course of 10 years, we dug a total of 65 trenches in the ground at Sigil Massa. And each of these trenches, well, the average size was 5 meters by 5 meters square. So picture that, 15 feet roughly by 15 feet. Some trenches were over 4 meters deep, 65 of these. And you dig with a trowel and a dustpan. So, among other things, archaeology is a very slow process. And in 10 years, we learned a lot, but there's a lot more to do there. These are the most substantial walls on the whole site. And local people told us that it was the mosque, and I was willing to believe that, but I certainly would have been more confident in believing it if there were some concrete evidence that it was a mosque. So if you were trying to identify a building as a mosque, what would you look for? What does a mosque have to have? No, they don't have to have, many of them have domes, but they don't have to have a dome. A wall facing Mecca, bingo. That's exactly what a mosque has to have, is a wall facing Mecca, and there's usually something on the wall, like a niche, to indicate that that's the Qibla wall. Qibla means direction facing Mecca. And the wall that comes closest to facing Mecca is this wall over here. Absolutely nothing on it, indicating the direction to Mecca. But shortly after this debate was going on in my head, I learned about the research of another scholar, Michael Bonin, University of Arizona, who did a study of the orientation of mosques in Morocco. And lo and behold, he discovered that almost every mosque in Morocco, all of the pre-15th century mosques, are facing the wrong direction. And not by a little bit, but by more than 35 degrees. Wow, that's a huge error. Such a huge error that given the fact that these people were so learned in astronomy and mathematics, that it couldn't have been a mistake. So they had to be thinking about something else, and what that something else is, we don't really know. But what we do know is that their concept of orientation of mosques was different at a certain point in time than at a certain point around the 15th century. It changed. But anyway, what I learned from that is we were looking at the wrong wall. And when we started looking at this wall, lo and behold, we found a break, a clean break in the wall, and the foundation for a niche. So there we go. We were pretty confident that that's what we had. In fact, here's the clean break. Most of the wall is missing, but it's present here and it's here. And there's the foundation for the niche. And then these two trenches were also a dead giveaway. Those two trenches had little fragments of wood in those trenches. And they were railroad ties. And they were wooden rails connecting the ties. And they were used for a movable minbar. A minbar is a chair upon which the preacher gives his Friday sermon. It's like a pulpit. And only in Morocco, only in North Africa, are minbars movable. So when it's time to give the sermon, they roll it out. When the sermon's over, they push it back. Okay, and so consequently, it's on wheels, and the wheels are on rails. And it's always, 100% of the time, immediately to the right of the niche as you're facing the niche. So the relationship of those two features was the proof that we had the mosque. But there were several layers to this mosque, several levels of occupation. and the uppermost one is here, and then there's a level here. It's a very clear. In fact, in the mosque, the stratigraphy was clearer than anywhere else on the site. I mean, it was neat. It was like layers of an onion that we could peel one off after the other. And in fact, there are two levels here, not one. You can probably see that. Can you see that the very top part of this is kind of gray, and then right below that is white? Well, there are two floors, one immediately on top of the other. And then there's another layer down here. Well, we could date this one by a text. And the text tells us that the last restoration of the mosque consisted of removing the roof of the mosque and putting a new roof on, and that was done by King Sidi Muhammad bin Abdullah. And I'm sure you all know who Sidi Muhammad bin Abdullah is, right? 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 No? Well, you should, and you will from now on, because Sidi Muhammad bin Abdullah is the first foreign ruler to recognize the independence of the United States. The oldest treaty that we have in our archives has the name Sidi Muhammad bin Abdullah written just above George Washington's name. He's a pretty important guy in our history. And it's amazing how few Americans know that. Any Moroccan could tell you that. Okay, so we know what the date of this floor is, late 18th century. Here is a little more complicated. And we had to figure that out by looking at architectural features below the ground or below that upper level of floor. And so these are, and there are several of these architectural features, and at first it was very confusing. Nothing made sense to me. And I remember looking at this view. I looked at this view probably for 2 weeks before it finally hit me what was going on here. So look at this picture and tell me what's wrong with this picture. And I assure you, it's not terribly obvious. It took me 2 weeks to notice it. You have 20 seconds. Okay, but I'll help you here. Okay, so if you look at the alignment of this, these squares are footings for columns, right? So column bases. And this one, if you draw a direct line, it doesn't line up. Oops. And the other one, of course, misses the mark completely, right? So that was puzzling, and so my next strategy was to connect those features which I knew went together, and there were many that didn't, but I used different colors chalk to connect columns that I knew went together and then other sets of columns that went together and so on and so on. Three different colors, yellow, white, and red. And this is what I ended up with. So I figured that there was an original mosque that was that, you know, based on these elements here. And we found traces of a wall back here. And then at a certain point, along comes another regime, and they decided that the mosque was too small, needed to enlarge it, and so they added an addition. But when they did that, can you see this? That you go about halfway. Here's the first niche. Second niche is here. That's the one that we found. But the alignment is different. In fact, the column bases are wider, and the orientation changes by about 2 degrees. Okay, this was fascinating. And so our first question is, who did that? I mean, who did this? Well, we know from history that there was one Moroccan dynasty that was famous for this. The Almohads, who succeeded the Almoravids, went around changing the orientation of mosques everywhere. Why? Because they were reformists. They came to power on a reformist ideology, and so they're thinking, by golly, the other guys have really screwed this up. I mean, we know that they got the orientation wrong. And by golly, we're going to straighten them out, literally and figuratively, right? Well, they came up with a different wrong orientation. But symbolically, that didn't matter. So who did it was the Almoravids, and we know that because they did it everywhere else. Okay, this was a characteristic of that particular regime, and we know that they came to power in Sidi Massa in 1147. So now we have another pretty definitive date. And then at the very lowest level here, so these two levels are the two mosques, the original one and then the expansion. And then below that, we have more architectural features. Ignore this. These go with the mosque. Okay, but this does not. So we have a courtyard here, step up into a room. There's another step up into a room here. On the other side of the mosque, we have, again, ignore the blocks. We have a stone wall here, 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 here. Those were partitions for smaller rooms. And this, behind all of that, a series of fire pits, one on top of the other, three levels of them, were in somebody's kitchen. This here actually was the trash pit full of chicken bones and goat bones, spoons, cooking pots. So we're in somebody's kitchen there. And this is a drawing of all of that. And this is an elite household below the mosque. Okay. And directly on the floor at that lowest level, we found this fragment of wood veneer. It's dirty here because it was covered with dirt, but you can see a design on it, right? And clean it up a little bit, and it was really pretty beautiful. And I have this friend, B.G. Martin. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of B.G. Martin. He's an Arabist, studies Arabic manuscripts, and he studied the most esoteric manuscripts known to man. And I guess he, for at least a half a dozen times when he saw me after I started this, he would ask me, have you found anything of the Beni Midrar? The Beni Midrar is a Berber tribe, very local. They rule nowhere except Sigil Massa. And no one's ever heard of them except B.G. Martin and me. And so he would ask me, have you found anything of the Beni Midrar? And I told him year after year after year, no, don't have it, until I found this. And this is prototypical art of the Beni Midrar, which nobody had ever seen for at least 1,000 years. And that was pretty exciting. And this is another thing of the Beni Midrar. It's a fragment of wall plaster. You can't see the design very well on the plaster, but when we were able to look at it closely and draw it out, it had an inscription. Three words are visible. This is a wow. It's most of it's missing. Wusaha Kasabat Aleha. The last word of three verses in the Quran. And it's rhyming, so you can figure out the rest of it, right? Poetry. And so this is it. This is the Arabic transliteration, and this is what it says in English. No soul doth God place a burden greater than it can bear. It gets every good that it earns and suffers every evil that it earns. This is very interesting, because it suggests the point at which Islam had reached. Most religions reach it sooner or later, where there's a debate going on, a theological debate, about salvation. Is salvation by faith or good works? Right? That debate that most religions have sooner or later. And the people who painted this particular wall plaster came down on one side of that issue. What side do you think? This is salvation by works theology, which happens to be the theology of the Beni Midrar. So this was a good confirmation of who we're dealing with there. So we're at this level, and we know we're not in a mosque anymore. We're in somebody's kitchen or a nice house, really elite house. And so at that level, in the 8th century level, we were not in the mosque. And so the original mosque, the 8th century mosque, had to be somewhere else. The standard procedure in early Islamic cities was to build a mosque right next to the governor's palace. So I'm thinking, I'm hoping, that's a better word, hoping that what we had found was the governor's palace. I mean, it was on the highest part of the town, you know, pretty elevated place under the new mosque, so an important place, maybe the governor's palace. If that's the case, the original mosque that's contemporary to that has to be right next to it. But we got four choices, right, four sides. Well, there's another rule. That the governor's palace is usually on the Qibla side of the mosque, the side facing Mecca. So if this is the palace, and if there's a mosque on the, or if it's on the Qibla side, which in the case of Sigil Massa was facing wrongly south, that means the mosque had to be north. Okay? So using a little bit of logic there, we dug north, and the only thing that we found from the original mosque, everything else has been raised by new construction, was this square column base and a circular part of a circular column. And there was actually one other one that we found a little bit further away. That's all that's left of the 8th century mosque of Sijil Massa, of the Beni Nadar Mosque. Okay, and then we have, this is a much more sophisticated map. This is the last map that we did using satellite images and an electronic distance measuring system. And this square here, this enclosure, had no architectural features in it. It was empty of architectural features. So I'm thinking that could only be one thing, and that's the weekly market. Pretty standard in Moroccan towns to have a weekly market, or if it's a really big town, a semi-weekly market, two a week. But there's no architecture there because these are like flea markets. So peddlers come and they set up their little stands, and then when the market day is over with, they go away, and it's empty. And so that's what I'm pretty sure this enclosure represents. This dock spot here in this map, it's a larger scale map, this represents downtown Sijil Massa, represents this. This dock spot here represents another market. This is the enclosure, only small pieces of which we found, you know, above ground. So the black line really is connecting dots, literally connecting dots. But there's this other marketplace outside that enclosure. So why outside the enclosure? It's actually 3 miles away from downtown. But you have to think, this is not an ordinary town. This is an international desert entrepot. And we read in text that the average caravan consisted of over 100 merchants, each merchant having what? 100 camels. Do a little bit of math, and you know you don't want that many camels. So think about it. I mean, think of the ecological issue of having a few thousand camels march through town, right? So outside of the whole enclosure, 3 miles out from the center, is this other marketplace. Okay. And one of the standard ways of distinguishing between residential and commercial in an archaeological setting is by statistically looking at the kind of pottery you have. Okay? And here's a good example of it. So the floor that we this is the surface, and we dug down to this point and found a floor, which you can't see because it's gone. We took the floor out. But immediately below the floor, we found this huge jar, and the floor covered it. And there was a hole in the floor, actually. And here you can see, okay, here's the practice. You would dig a hole in the floor of your house and place this big jar down into the hole, leaving a space around it, this much space, so that the jar can breathe. And then you keep the jar wet, water evaporates, evaporation is a cooling process. This is a refrigerator. Burns almost no electricity, it's very efficient, and it really works. Now we had one elderly worker, I hired him the first season and I kept him right up through the end. Mohammed Ben Barak, you remember Ben. Steve Brown is one of my closest friends, by the way. He was a student of mine back in the 70s and worked with me at Sijil Massa. And so this man, Mohammed Ben Barak, was a great old man. But he told us when we found this that he said, you know, my grandfather, he was 72 years old at the time, Ben Barak was, and his grandfather, he said, had one of these and it worked. He could keep butter from melting in the desert in the summer when the temperature goes up to 130 degrees. So these things work.
Where you wrap the food up and put it in the pot?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
That's
but think of your refrigerator at home. I mean, how often do you go out and buy a new refrigerator? Not really often. And how many do you have? Well, you know, we're a pretty affluent society now, so some of us have two refrigerators. But the norm, I would say, is basically one refrigerator per household, right? So a refrigerator is a low replacement item. And here's the rule. A low percentage of low replacement items means residential. Now, if we were to find a unit with 35 refrigerators, probably not a house. Probably a place that sold refrigerators or made refrigerators. Right. So, and conversely, a high percentage of low replacement items means commercial or industrial. So that's how this works. All right, let's move to the other site. Brian told me to talk for 45 minutes, so I got about lots of time. Okay. But he also said he was taking us out to dinner after. So it's not going to be a whole lot longer. All right, so here we are in Marrakesh. You've all heard of Marrakesh. It's one of the most beautiful cities in Morocco. It's really great. And if you, how many of you have ever been to Morocco? So you went to Marrakesh, I hope?
Yeah.
It's great. It's a great place. I mean, I love Marrakesh. And so the next time you go, you want to go to Agmat. There's now something to see there, actually. There hasn't been anything to see up until this past year. It's not exactly true. There was one other thing, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But you leave Marrakesh on this highway here. Highway is a bit of a euphemism, but it's highway P-2017. And that's where Agmat is, exactly 30 kilometers from the southern edge of Marrakesh. And you'll know you get there because this little road sign, and the sign actually says Jemaa Rmat. Rmat is kind of a colloquialization, is that a word? Whatever, of the medieval name Agmat. Jemaa means gathering place, and that's it. The arrow is pointing off to the left, so you get down to the intersection here and you turn left. And at that point, you see this sign here, and that sign is the other thing that you could see, and that's been there, since 1970. And it's the tomb of, that's what it says here, it's the tomb of Mu'tamid bin Abad. Mu'tamid bin Abad was the king of Seville in Spain in the 11th century. The poet king, actually. He was a very, very good poet, beautiful poet. And he was captured by the Almoravids, taken prisoner, and brought to Agmat, where he died several years later. So he was kind of kept in house arrest. And his tomb is there in Jemaa Rmat. But the tomb was built in 1970. Okay. In fact, maybe this is a good point to tell you how I got involved in this. See, I retired a few years ago. Retired. What a joke. And I had no intention of ever doing another major cityscape. I mean, it's 10 years of your life is a lot to give to a project. And I'm thinking, no, I'm retired now. I'm not going to do this anymore. But the wife of the former U.S. ambassador to Morocco, Vanessa Vreeland is her name, she and her husband actually bought some property in this little village. And the first time she went there, the villagers took her to see the tomb of Mu'tamid bin Abad. And she noticed, this is built in 1970. I mean, this is not authentic. This is not medieval. I want to see the real stuff, she said. And so this little kid said, oh, you want to see the old stuff? So they took her to this broken down building, just the roof of which was sticking up out of the ground. And it turns out to be quite a magnificent monumental building, which she could recognize that as being important. And so that's when they called me. They said, you got to come and spend a week with us, and we have something to show you. And they showed me this. And what can we do about it? And I said, I don't know what I can do about it. I said, I'm not doing anything about it. I'm retired. But I said, this is a Ministry of Culture issue. And I said, if you want to do something about this, I'll make an appointment with the Secretary General of the Ministry of Culture. So I called him out. And we got an appointment. So the ambassador and I went to see the Minister of Culture, Secretary General of the Ministry of Culture, and basically he said, yeah, okay, you guys get the money, you can do it. And that's how it works. If you come with money, you can do the project. So anyway, we're now driving into the village. This is the village that's there today, not too far from the site, half a kilometer from the site maybe. And just as you're coming into town, there's a little dirt road that goes left right here. And this is the building that they had taken it to. Okay, and just the roof is sticking up. And they described it as the bath, the hammam of the ancient city. Whatever else Agmat is, it's a place where historical figures became legend, starting with Mu'tamid bin Abad. This is his tomb, the tomb that was built in 1970. Presumably, there was a tomb somewhere there before. We know that, at least according to the texts, that he was indeed buried somewhere in the city. And so this is the modern tomb. It's actually the replica of a medieval building in Marrakesh. And it's a good replica. I did a pretty good job with it. But it's made out of cement. And another one of the very famous characters from medieval Akhmat is this woman by the name of Zainab, and this is a novel that came out this year, actually. Zainab, Queen of Marrakesh. And I bought the novel and read it while I was there. We're walking around her ruins. And that was pretty neat, actually. And she's famous because she wasn't original to Akhmat. She was actually born in the Tunisian city of Kairouan. And she came, her father was a merchant, and ended up in Akhmat. And she said, even when she was a little girl, that she would not marry anybody but a king. And she actually ended up marrying four. Two local Akhmat rulers, and then she married the first two rulers of the Almoravid Empire. And so, you know, I guess she was determined. Now, much of what we know about her, mind you, is legend. But legend is based on something. Anyway, she's a very interesting character. But it's a city that's important in its own right, actually. And we know that from several medieval Arab writers. The first of them is this man, Ibn Hawqal, who wrote about Akhmat in the mid-900s. Ibn Hawqal is one of the first CIA agents. I mean, that's what he was. He was a spy. Let's try to think of a euphemism. He was a gatherer of intelligence. And when he submitted his intelligence reports, they were in geographic form. He sounded like a geographer. He even illustrated his reports with maps. So really, really a very accomplished individual. Anyway, his description of Akhmat was as a very wealthy city. See, the kind of intelligence he was gathering, by the way, he worked for the Fatimid dynasty, which was a very imperialistic dynasty. And basically, he was supposed to assess whether this place was worth conquering or not. You know, is this going to be cost efficient to take over this place? And Akhmat was, according to his estimation. He said there were none richer than the merchants of Akhmat. And he talked about Akhmat in the same breath that he talked about all of Andalusia, or all of Ifriqiya. Ifriqiya is the whole region of Tunisia. And the city of Akhmat was like those places. Wow. Almost 100 years later, al-Bakri says almost the same thing. And he talks about it in glowing terms as being rich. There are none richer than the merchant. I mean, these guys in my class today would be guilty of plagiarism for sure, because they're using the same words. Probably copying them from a writer 100 years earlier without footnotes. And then still another 100 years later is al-Idrisi. But he adds something else. He parrots what the other two writers said, none richer than the merchants of Akhmat. But as I'm writing this book, they are beginning their decline. Okay, so that was a new piece of information and a very interesting piece. Now, the village that I keep referring to is down here in these trees. And what you need to notice are these mountains in the background. That's the High Atlas Mountains. And at this particular point, they form a horseshoe. And they really envelop the site, or Akhmat, site of medieval Akhmat, on three sides. And when the Almoravids came here, the Almoravids, you know, they came as latecomers here. The Akhmat existed for a long time before the Almoravids came. The Almoravids are desert people, very uncomfortable in the mountains. In fact, they didn't know how to wage warfare in the mountains. That was not their thing. And so when they settled here in Akhmat and they used it as their capital city for 11 years, they constantly felt threatened by the tribesmen up in the mountains who circled them on three sides. And so this is my idea now. I mean, there are other people who have different ideas, but I'm convinced that they decided that they had to leave. And so they went to where Marrakesh is today, which at that time was an empty plain. And so now we're in Marrakesh looking south. This is Highway 2016 or 17. And we have to go all the way back here, 30 kilometers, before we get to Akhmat, but it's flat as a pancake, and that's the point. and the medieval texts tell us that the Almoravids felt comfortable here because they could see the enemy coming 30 kilometers away. You know, a marching army is going to kick up an awful lot of dust. This is a map that we generated of the site of Akhmat, and there are traces beyond or in addition to the Hammam of the Middle Ages. So right along this footpath here, we found traces of adobe wall. So that's part of the circuit wall of the city. It's the only part that we could find. A little bit further north where this red square is, we found traces of a wall, also medieval. What it is, I have no idea. And then where these yellow spots are, and this is a trace of a segia. A segia is a canal. And so dry today, but when there's water, the canal goes right between these stones. And so that, I think, is probably an emplacement for a water wheel of some kind or a water machine. This is an oil press, and we're now actually behind the picture. And we'll come up here and look at this. That's a basin that looks like that. And I didn't work on any of these. I mean, this is a sort of a cursory ground survey to see what's around. But then in the center of it all is right here. And that's where I spent two seasons now working on this building, which is the building that Vanessa Vreeland was primarily interested in. Okay? So in the summer of 2005, our task was to evacuate the interior fill. I mean, the building was almost full up to the top of rubble. Well, filled up to here. Okay, so you can see, this is after we dug a good bit of it out, but the rubble was right up to this level. Okay. And then when we got to the bottom, I mean, look at the beautiful arches. I mean, these are incredible. And so this is really a monumental building, and huge, 15 meters by 15 meters square. And of course, when we emptied it out, we could then establish a floor plan, a plan for the building. And so this is it. This is the plan, three rooms. This is a three-dimensional model of it. But this would be, in the fashion of a Roman bath, a cold water bath, and then a medium temperature bath, and a hot bath here. Okay, and I'll explain a little bit more about that in a minute. Ceramics that we found in the lowest level, a sealed level right above the floor of the hammam. The rule here at a level, at any level, is that you date a level by the newest things in it, the most recent things in it. And this collection of ceramics here are 14th century ceramics. And so we judge by that the building was used as a bath through the 14th century. Okay, when was it built? We don't know. But it was used as a bath until the end of the 14th century. Okay, so just remember that. Just above that, at a higher level, I'm telling the story backwards because we found this first, right? Because you start at the top and go down. But we found, we're looking, these two things are the same. So we're looking at these two squares. Now we're looking at them from the top. Badly made, I mean, terrible, terrible construction. And at the bottom of each of these is a stone like that, little holes in the stones. And that hole would be formed by a pole like this with an iron peg at the bottom. And on top of it is a potter's wheel. These are potter's stations. So apparently after they used this building as a bath, potters took it over for what turns out to be a very large-scale pottery industry. And so we're talking now 15th century, 16th century, maybe even 17th century. We know they used it as a potter's industry place for a long time because in this case we found three of these stones, one on top of the other, and a stone like that doesn't wear out quickly. These partitions were also made by the potters. They're reorganizing space for their industry, but they needed a place to mix different clays and so on. And we found potter's clay, mixed but unshaped. So here and here, we found potter's clay shaped but not fired. And this was one of the most goosebumpy type of things that we found, actually. This is a piece of potter's clay, two fingerprints in it. And those fingerprints are at least 500 years old. So that's when you begin to have direct contact with these people. The summer of 2006, this past summer, we moved outside of the building. So the first season, we feel comfortable that we pretty much finished the inside. We have a little bit of more work to do, but we decided we needed to find out, we really wanted to find out when the building was built. And we couldn't do that on the inside, we had to go outside. But we need to get into foundation trenches. So this is the south side of the building, and so we marked out a trench 4 meters wide and then the whole length. So it's actually 15 meters long, 4 meters wide, and we started going down. Okay, this is the first day. And then this is about third day. And actually we found a floor level. We're still pretty close to the top, but a floor level here. And right on that floor, a coin. Coin is 19th century. Pretty late, I mean, very recent. So what we have here are levels of occupation outside the hammam that are, you know, 100 years old or so, maybe 150 years old. Now, by the end of the summer, we had gone all the way down to the bottom. This is floor level, even with the floor of the hammam down here. Several fragments of wall, not fragments of walls, foundations for walls. But these would be all of the, annexes to the hammam, dressing rooms, entrance room, and so on. I mean, if you went to a hammam today, they would have all of these facilities, a place to change, a place to put your clothes, a place to take up the money. And so that's what we have here. And we're looking from west to east. This is a picture now looking from east to west. It's the same picture from the opposite end. And you'll notice in both of them that there's something here in the middle. And we only went about halfway down in the middle because we saw all of this stuff. And this is industrial something. Industrial what? No idea. And I didn't have enough time to find out. I only had about 4 days left when we got to that point of the excavation. And I'm thinking, no, I'm not touching this, because I'll screw it up. You go too fast and, you know, you lose it. So that's where we start next May, this coming May. But there is one other thing we have to look at here, and that's this corner here. So look at that, and then we'll look at it closer up. So this is actually a canal that's covered over with these stones, and there's a canal down here. And at this point right here, the canal divides into two different channels. And in this part of the excavation, we found a lot of these kinds of pots, very thick, heavy pots with very heavy bases. And those, I mean, it's a dead giveaway. These pots are something very specific. They're Nuria pots. A Nuria is a water wheel. Okay. Here's a medieval manuscript showing how to make a water wheel. And there are two kinds here, actually. This is a rope, and there are pots tied onto it. And here's a wheel with pots sticking to it. But here's what most of them look like in Morocco. Okay, so here's a water wheel, and they tie these clay pots onto the wheel. The canal turns the wheel. You know, as the water flows, it turns the wheel, and the pot that's tied to the wheel goes under the water, picks up water, and it comes up to the top like this, and when it gets to this point, it dumps the water out into a little canal. So this is like a medieval pump. Machine to lift water. Absolutely necessary in our case because the canal that feeds the city is lower than the floor of the hammam. Right, so to get the water from a lower level to a higher level to feed the bath, they need some kind of a pump. And we don't have the pump yet, but it's got to be within 20 meters from the corner of the hammam to the canal. It's about 20 meters unexcavated yet, but that's task number two for this summer. And here's where we are, in this corner. So the water comes from the pump into that canal that splits here. It goes around here and it feeds all the way here. This is where they heated the water. This is the hypocaust. It also heated air that went under the floor. And then the water also fed this room here, which was a hot water bath. And then red means evacuation, so that's wastewater. And that's under the floor, actually, and it came. This is the only part that we excavated. But I assume that it kept going out the bath. this is a cistern here, and I think this water was collected by, it was rainwater. They had actually little canals on top of the roof, so I think they gathered roof water, or runoff water from the roof, into this basin here. And these were like water spigots to fill up pails and so forth. Okay, well, we certainly created a lot of preservation issues as we did this, as we took all of this dirt from inside the hammam and then took the dirt away from the outside of the wall on the south side. You know, that dirt for 500 or 600 years was holding the building up. Yeah, right, so there's a serious preservation issue, so we had to address that issue. And so we hired a historic preservation company that was recently founded by two young, really very bright young Moroccans who are graduates from the National Institute for Archaeology in Morocco. And here they are, there's the two of them. The name of their company is Patrimonium. And so we hired them to sort of consolidate the building. That basically means make sure it doesn't fall down. Okay, and the first step was to take the debris off the roof. There were tons of dirt on top of the roof. And so that's actually what they're doing here. And this is what the roof looked like after they took all the dirt off. But one of the things they discovered, so these are the vaults. So there's one vault here, another one here, third one here. No, I guess this is first, second, third. But they found these walls, or foundation for walls, on top of the hammam. That's our 19th century level. So at some point, you know, after dirt had accumulated around the hammam, somebody came along and used the hammam as the foundation for a house. You know, who that was, no idea what they used it for, no idea, they probably just lived it. But they also found some artifacts in this excavation on top of the hammam, including this 19th century dagger, hanja, and another 19th century coin, in fact the date is as clear as can be, 1257, that's the Muslim date, Hijra date, so that's very early 1800s. But that wasn't the most remarkable thing. The most remarkable thing were these things. Okay, and actually the arm is cut off here, the picture goes a little bit over. But this is a little clay statue. It's about this tall. Has anybody ever seen anything like that? I mean, when I saw it, the first thing that came to mind was a Phoenician fertility goddess, right? I mean, it looks very Phoenician. And I just got back from Rome, actually, and I showed this to a colleague in Rome, and he said, "Yeah," he said, "that's what it looks like." But they made toys in the Middle Ages, you know, these little clay dolls. And I said, "Yeah," but and then I showed him this. That's a pre-Roman coin, probably Numidian. And he said, "Oh, well, this changes everything." You know, this opens the possibility that this is indeed an ancient fertility goddess. And if that's the case, we have to begin to rethink presence in Moroccan cities in this part of Morocco. I mean, push it way back. I mean, up until now, I was convinced that 8th century at the very earliest, AD this is, but now we got to go 3rd, 4th, 5th century BC. So this is potentially a pretty big thing. This is some of their work. Patrimonium did some reinforcing inside, so you know, walls were broken, and in strategic places support walls were broken. So they filled in using different color mortar, actually, so you could tell the difference between old and new. So this is all reinforced here. This is reinforced, this is reinforced. So I mean, I'm really pleased with what they did. I mean, they did a great job. But one of the things that I'm really proudest about in this project is this is French here, Comité de Suivi, that means follow-up committee. So this is a committee that was formed to ensure that this project continues to move forward. Long term, that is. That means the creation of an interpretation center, a museum, place where you folks can come and see and learn something about this place, right? And so this is the governor of the province where the site is located. This is the mayor of the village where the site is located. This is the inspector of monuments from Marrakesh, and this is his zone. And this is the governor of the commune, the president of the local commune, which is sort of an agency parallel to the mayor's office, but he has money, he doesn't. So he's, you know, I mean, they collect the taxes. The commune collects the taxes, and so they have to pay for roads or, you know, whatever public services take place, and also, you know, support really nice cultural projects. And this is the Secretary General of the Minister of Culture, so that's the man that I approached to get permission to do all of this, and he's, you know, of course, all cultural heritage projects come under his jurisdiction. And then this is the current U.S. ambassador. And at the end of each of these two seasons, I made a point of, well, second time at his request, first time my request, to brief him at the end and let him know what was going on. And that was quite an opportunity, actually, to sit down face to face with the U.S. ambassador and tell him what you're doing. This second year around, you know, as I was meeting with him, I saw on his calendar he had blocked out 30 minutes for this meeting, and I stayed for an hour and 45 minutes. So he was really interested. And at the end of the session, he suggested, see, each ambassador can nominate one project for the Special Ambassador's Fund each year. So he decided that this would be a great project for him to nominate for support with your tax dollars. And here's the former ambassador and his wife. This is Freck Vreeland and Vanessa Vreeland. They supported the first season of work. I know personally, that came out of their end, but then we got, and this is another thing that I'm really delighted about. What makes this project so exciting is that the Moroccan government has jumped in with both feet, and private individuals, wealthy Moroccans, have jumped into this project to support it. So for the first time in my whole career, I have not had to worry where the money was going to come from. And one of our supporters is the president of Hertz Morocco. And so last season, for the first time in my whole life, I was able to drive back and forth to the site in a brand new air-conditioned car lent to me by Hertz Morocco. So this sketch is getting better and better. Now there's an historiographic issue that I've become very interested in, and that's another link between this site and the previous site. And that is, in both cases, historical texts stop talking about the cities at a certain specific point in time, 14th century. And in fact, the implication is, and in the case of Sigil-Massa, the statement is not implied, it's stated directly, that the city collapsed. Ceased to exist. But yet, the archaeological evidence is quite to the contrary. I mean, we know that there was occupation. Well, you saw the evidence of occupation up through the 18th, 19th century. So why do these cities fall off the radar screen? And what happens to them? Well, what happens to them is what we would describe in our environment, I think, as urban slide. And the city is not disappearing, it's moving. It's gravitating in one direction or another. And in this case, so here we are at the site, looking south-southwest. Here's the tomb of Mu'tam bin Abad, 1970. Here's the village around it. Here's the market, by the way, today. And it's empty except for poles that they put up for their canopies on flea market day. And back to Sigil-Massa just briefly, here's the site and the town. There's actually a new town, modern Risani, is here south-southwest, same direction. Oddly enough, same direction. Now, what explains why historians lost sight of it? I'm working on that. I'm really studying the text to try to figure that out. And I have some suspicions, but that would be a different lecture. And it's almost supper time. I'm not sure why I put this. Well, our life has become so much easier. The first season I worked in Sigil-Massa, Steve remembers this well, we had to take a taxi 15 miles north to another town to call to make a telephone call, because that's where the telephone was. And so now it's very easy with a cell phone. You know, this was actually a phone call that I got from my 7-year-old granddaughter. So can you imagine? That was so exciting. It's just wonderful. And she was in a play this summer. She was reciting her lines in the play. where all of these people are waiting for their next instructions. And then just four more slides and I'm done, and these will be quick. It was very easy for us to imagine what either of these cities were like 1,000 years ago on market day. Right? And so you've been to market day in some of these towns probably. And you can tell it's market day because traffic is very heavy going into town. So this is early Sunday morning. Sunday is the big market in Risani, which is modern Sigilmessa. Parking lot is full. Hard to get a parking spot. But the wares that one can find in this market are really quite remarkable. In fact, guidebooks of Morocco today describe this as the last authentic Berber market in the country. And I think that's probably correct. And a lot of stuff you find in this market is not intended for tourists, because there are not that many tourists there. I mean, I hope that changes at some point. But if any of you really like Berber jewelry, this is the place to go. It's where you'll get the best prices anywhere in Morocco. And then one day, these German tourists did come. I mean, they don't come in huge numbers, but they do come. And I'm thinking, well, there goes my picture of medieval Sigilmessa. But then I thought, I mean, that image went away very quickly when I reminded myself that 1,000 years ago, Sigilmessa was an international city. And there would have been Europeans there. And so I said, okay, this fits. I'm making stay. I like this picture very much. And then immediately to the south is the road to Timbuktu. So there it is.